Now broadcasting the Webcomic Beacon.
I will be editing this as much as possible in the beginning part, but most of you, I guess, in the audience already know that we are the Webcomic Beacon crew of webcomicbeacon.com. We've done a webcomic podcast for, I would say, at least 95% of all the weeks that we've existed, near weekly. Now we're trying to cut back one day a month, but that's hasn't worked entirely well. We've been in existence for over 2 years, ever since December 2007. And we just posted episode 116 up yesterday. And this would be episode 117, live from PenguinCon 2010 at the Troy Marriott in Troy, Michigan. And, well, of course, I'm Fess of PSIWebcomic.com. To the left of me is the flinching Tanya Higgins of DaysIt'sAndShit.com. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
And we have Mark Savory of AutumnLake.com to my right.
Well, hello there.
And this is why you normally prepare yourself. We have...
My name's Howard Taylor.
Howard Taylor. It was Howard something.
My name's Howard something, and I write and illustrate something, something, something at something.com.
I do apologize. Normally I'm on the ball, but...
No.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that.
Normally you're a fat liar.
As you can tell, we are not the professionals here. He is the professional here from Slot Mercenary.
The professional who just opened... Oh, sorry, label out. The professional who just opened his can of soda in front of the microphone. Sorry. Boy, that really refreshes.
Something has magically opened the door. So
okay.
For those of you not benefiting from the video, it's just chaos in this room. So.
Madness.
Cats
utter
and
madness.
Dogs living together. Mass hysteria.
Okay. You know, we watched that movie with my 14-year-old daughter. And she looked at it. She says, "Wait, was this supposed to be scary or funny?" And we said, "Well, honey,
which
are you finding it?" She says, "Well, mostly nothing."
Excellent.
And I said, "Oh no, but some of these lines are funny, right?" And she says, "Yeah, but they're funnier when your friend Bob says them."
You know, it's kind of true.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to have digressed. Do you have an introductory spiel?
So. Digressed? I was going to say improved.
Oh, all right.
That was the introductory spiel. You've done heard it now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Webcomics Beacon.
Woo!
As I mentioned before, we actually started the podcast for our listening audience, who will get this much, much later. This is the first time I actually have the full... set up with a mixer and several microphones, and so hopefully this is going to be a very great, funny, disastrous show for everyone to enjoy, because those are the highest traffic shows we have.
Yeah.
For some reason.
It's only when we fail that anyone cares.
I guess so. Or when I go start causing trouble on the Something Awful forums. But...
Please don't get any of that on me. Please,
no, that was last year. I stopped trolling, I guess.
We'll keep our ooze.
I was lurking, I wasn't trolling.
I'm just sitting here, don't mind me. I don't get into none of that stuff.
You should interview our guest.
We should. So, Mr. Taylor. Can I call you Mr. Taylor?
You can call me Howard. You can also call me Mr. Taylor, but I go by Howard.
All right, Howard, Mr. Taylor. So you do this webcomic called Schlock Mercenary. Now, a lot of the younger webcomicers online may not be familiar with the more realistically successful webcomics that have, tested the waters and have...
Let me first object to the term realistically successful. The success that I have currently enjoying is completely unrealistic beyond my expectations, okay? I count myself fortunate. I don't think that I can offer advice by telling you, how I did it in order to get you to do it so that it works, because I've never failed at it. And I'm not saying that to blow my own horn. I'm saying you want to learn from somebody who failed and failed and failed and failed and then got it right, and they can tell you, well, I changed it. I took a very scientific approach and finally changed enough things and it worked. In my own business, I was an independent record producer for 5 years, and we failed a lot at the accounting and running the inventory and doing the marketing. And so when I started the Schlock Mercenary business, we had a bunch of failures, but they weren't failures in the comic book industry. In the comic book industry, I just got really lucky. So, sorry, I digressed. So
no.
Keep going with the question.
So on that note, there was one of the things that a lot of people that know the show know, that we essentially spawned off of a forum called the Webcomic List.
Okay.
And recently there was a discussion about buffers and whether or not they're good or bad for when you're starting a comic, blah, blah, blah. Aside from that, one of the questions that had come out of this forum was, has anybody, like the successful webcomicers, was there anybody that has no buffer, that's never missed an update?
Is there anybody who doesn't have a buffer who's never missed an update?
Yes.
No. To my knowledge, no. That's everybody I've talked to who has never missed an update works ahead. They may only, now sometimes they, you know, they may have come down to where, you know, a buffer of one and they were scrambling to catch up, but I only know of maybe half a dozen comics that haven't missed updates, and you know, of those, I don't know of any other than maybe Kevin and Kel that are daily.
Yeah.
And of course, Bill Holbrook is a machine. He works for the syndicates. Mm-hmm. I say he works for the syndicates.
Two days.
I think he has three.
Does he have three?
On the Fast Track, Safe Havens, and Kevin and Kel. And this man works a month or more ahead, and that's why he's able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I try to work so that on Monday mornings I am 33 days ahead inked. Monday morning, it's dropped to 33, mm-hmm. and I will, over the course of the week, work it back up so that next Monday it drops to 33 again. At the moment, I've dropped all the way to, this Monday I'll drop to 19, and that's because I got really busy, I got really sick, I injured my hand, mm-hmm. I had the sorts of things that would shut down somebody who has no buffer, mm-hmm. it shut them down for 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I shed 3 weeks of buffer. It actually dropped all the way to 12. I shed 3 weeks of buffer so that I could get a book done and so that I could deal with Epstein-Barr for 2 weeks, so that I could have a bout of carpal tunnel because I'm an idiot. I penciled 10 pages of bonus story in one night so that I could sit down with Brandon Sanderson and Dan Wells. You guys know who Brandon Sanderson is. Finishing the Wheel of Time for Robert Jordan. Brilliant writer. And I wanted to workshop my writing. I wanted to workshop my story with him. And I told him, but I don't think it'll work without the pictures. And he said, well, the only time I've got available is tomorrow around lunch. And this was today around breakfast. And I said, oh, well, I'd better get busy then. And so I penciled the whole thing and hurt myself. The point being, without the buffer, I never could have done what I'm doing. And I've known a lot of cartoonists who only work 1 or 2 days ahead, and who succeeded in having, you know, long, unbroken strings of updates. I think Chris Crosby regularly works just a few days ahead, but then he got snowed in, and the snow ate his 3-day buffer, mm-hmm. and, you know, he couldn't update because there was no internet connection there in Kresbarg, Far Egypt, South Dakota, wherever.
Yeah.
What did R.C. Monroe say?
I think he's never missed an update, and he's like 18 weeks ahead, and he updates
it was
6 days
crazy,
a week.
Crazy amount of time ahead.
He had 152.
See, Randall Monroe, the XKCD?
No. He does Out There.
R.C. Monroe does Out There.
Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with that.
It's a black and white
newspaper style strip, and
okay.
he used to update 7 days a week, then he dropped to 6, and basically he has a night job where he can do a whole bunch of strips because he doesn't have to do anything. So kind of cheating
job.
Almost, but then again,
it's you know what? If you are spending time grinding on your comic, that's not cheating. Now, you might be cheating on your boss, but it's still
that's
hard
acceptable.
Work. It's not like you're getting the comic for free.
True.
No.
And he's definitely earned that. And
no, this is just Fest making himself feel better. It's okay.
No, I wanted to make sure to bring him up is all. Because he's never missed an update.
Okay. And how long has he been doing this?
Five years.
That's fantastic.
Four or five.
Four or five, something like that.
Fantastic. But how far ahead does he work?
Like I said, last we talked to him, because we had him on the show, he said he was 18 weeks ahead.
It was a stupid
18 weeks.
Yeah. 18
weeks
ahead. Yeah. Oh, gosh.
See, my goal, and I'll share this freely, I want to be far enough ahead that I can put a book into print and be selling it and tell my readers who are reading the comic online, the next 5 or 6 weeks of story are in this book that I'm holding in my hands right now that I want to be able to sell you.
I
feel like I'm leaving money on the table by publishing things that have been on the web for, you know, 5 years already. What we're actually going to do with the current storyline, Family Antimatter, is as soon as I'm done with the story, we're going to go to print. I mean, I have to put a bonus story into it, but I can do that. I can run that in parallel.
Right.
So we're laying out the book. We're going to go to print as soon as it's done, which means that within 3 months of the story ending, people will have the books in their hands. So I'm not quite there yet,
right.
But with 6 to 8 weeks of buffer, oh, I could pull that off.
Yeah.
I could pull that off.
So one of the things about buffer, another thing about the buffer is also depending on how often you update. Now, a lot of the more, I would say, the big guys of webcomics essentially tend to update a lot more frequently than everyone else, which is usually like at least 5 days a week is what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think the reason for that is that the guys who are doing it, the big guys who are doing it professionally, I want to make sure we get the cart on the right side of the horse here. They may not necessarily be the big guys because they're doing it 5 days a week. They may be doing it 5 days a week because now they can.
Yeah.
I find it fascinating that Penny Arcade guys only update the strip 3 days a week. And I looked at that for the longest time and thought, man, what are they doing with all their free time? Just playing video games? Well, no. They've got other comic projects that are airing in other places. Mm-hmm. They're working their butts off. And we're only getting 3 days a week of free.
Right.
And I am fine with that. I'm, you know, the mercenary in me rejoices at what they've accomplished. I think that's brilliant.
Right. That's the other thing. I wanted to backtrack and ask. You said it was basically luck, that of your success was a lot of luck. So how long after you started doing the comic and publishing it online did you look and say, whoa, I got something big here?
Okay, I started creating comics in March of 2000.
Okay.
I didn't start putting them on the web immediately, but I started creating comics, and I thought, wow, this is a fun way to tell a story. Wow, this is the first time I've been passionate about something that I was creating in years. And I was so passionate about it, I thought, I want to do this for a living. And so I immediately started researching what was available. Mm-hmm. And I sent off a packet for syndication.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that, you know, they weren't interested. One guy said, I actually got one personalized note from, by way of rejection, I can't remember who it was from, and he said, this looks like it might work better in comic books. And that was it. I got my rejection letters, and I thought, oh, well, might as well go to the web, because Pete Abrams doing it, Iliad's doing it, you know, J.D. Frazier is doing it with User Friendly.
Yeah.
We're talking about 2000 here, okay?
Yeah.
Now, at the time, and this is the sweet irony of all this, I was completely ignorant of the fact that there were already hundreds of comics on the web that had, readership comparable to... not comparable with Sluggy, because Sluggy and User Friendly were you know, the heavy hitters then. But there were hundreds of strips that had reader counts between 2 and 10,000.
Right.
And I had no idea that I was stepping into a playing field that was that crowded. I thought, you know what? I can do this. I can work ahead. Obviously, it's not that hard to draw this stuff. This was... you know, cocky idiot who's never drawn before, looking at the work of J.D. Frazier and Pete Abrams and saying, oh, hell, I can do that. All right? And here's the thing. I was wrong. I was dead wrong. You compare my artwork from 2000 to their artwork from 2000,
yeah.
And mine is very obviously built out of pure, unadulterated suck. but I was right. I can do that, and that attitude is what enabled me to keep trying. I proceeded ahead out of blissful, blithe ignorance. And then when I discovered, oh my gosh, there's so many people doing webcomics, who do I think I am? I realized, oh, you know what? I've been telling these people, I think I'm Howard Taylor, and I write Schlock Mercenary, and I'm going to be a professional cartoonist, and I just need to stick to those guns. So I did. At that point, and this was about September of 2000, I realized that I needed to come up with a business plan, and I came up with a 10-year plan that said, after 10 years, I'm going to be doing this full-time. Mm-hmm. So, sometime in September of 2010, note, this is being recorded in April of 2010, I thought, you know what, I'm going to be able to do it full-time by then. In 2004, I attended my first PenguinCon and realized that there was this world of science fiction, whatever, these conventions, fell in love with the idea of not working for Novell anymore. And by the end of 2004, Sandra and I prayerfully and with great trepidation had decided that it was time for me to quit my day job. The day job was paying me, and I'll say this freely because I've said it before, my salary at Novell was $100,870 per year at the time I quit.
I was pulling down
a six-figure salary to be a dick.
Yeah.
That was my job. Now, granted, I was really good at it. No, wait, that came off wrong. I knew so much about the product and the customers and all this. I gave all that up for a gig that was paying me negative $600 a month.
Yeah.
Did I know it was going to work then? No. I wrote about this at the time. I knew that, because of the prayer that we put into this decision, that essentially God had told me, time to quit the day job, but he hadn't told me, you're going to succeed as a web cartoonist. Because that's kind of the way these faith things work. Mm-hmm. So I plowed ahead with that, and for 15 months, we made 3 months' worth of money just keep lasting. Now, understand, this was me and my wife and my four kids that are all on this moneyless adventure.
Adventure!
Yeah. And in February of 2006, Steve Jackson and I talked. He had been planning on publishing the comic for me. And I realized that if I published through him, the royalty I was going to get was going to be so low that even if we sold at the most optimistic level, I'd be out of business before the book came into print. And I told that to Steve, and bless his heart, he said, you should self-publish.
Yeah.
Steve, I don't want to self-publish. We carried record production inventory in my basement for years. Sandra swore we'd never do inventory again. He said, just please look into it.
Yeah.
Please look into it. I mean, he kind of pushed me in that direction. Mm-hmm. And I went and looked into it, and Sandra and I, in March, decided to self-publish. And literally bet the farm. Well, we don't own a farm, so technically that's not literally. We said, all right, we've got enough money to get to June. Right now, we've got enough money to get us to June. If we spend all of that money, we can get into the end of April, and we spend a chunk of it to put down the down payment on 5,000 books.
Right.
Put in the down payment, and I remember getting the books back from getting the advance copy back from the printer and looking at it. And that was the moment I got to this part of the story, really the long way around. I'm so sorry. I opened that package and looked at the book and held it in my hands and wept as I realized people are going to buy this. I know, now that I'm holding it and smelling it and flipping through the pages, I know I can sell this. And I haven't given my $7,500 to a scam who's going to run away with my money.
Right.
We opened up pre-orders, and in 12 hours, we paid for the print run. In a day, I'd socked away enough money to get by for another month. And within 30 days, we'd sold enough books on pre-orders that we'd paid the bills for the next 6 months.
That's brilliant.
It's fantastic, and it's when I say it's dumb luck, it's miraculous. It's not a story I'm encouraging anybody else to try and follow because it's so incredibly risky. Because it just as easily could have gone south, and I would have been begging at Novell's doorstep come May 1st. Please, can I have my old job back because I'm hungry? But at that point, it had been 15 months. My knowledge was old. My contacts were stale. They wouldn't have hired me back.
Right.
It had been too long. With 6 months in the bank, we realized, we can make more books. All I have to do is make another book. I've got 6 months to put another book in print, and we're fine. So that was really the moment there in April of 2006 when I knew it would work. That's 6 years of making comics before I had tangible proof that I could make a living at it. Everything else up until then had been empty promises, small paychecks, big bills going to conventions, and a passion for comics that kept me doing it in spite of that. Mm-hmm.
There is one step of this that I think is important to know for most people. You did finally get to after 6 years, as you were mentioning, and I'm hearing you say you're printing 5,000 books. It's like, do you know how many people that are reading your comic right now?
Oh, yeah, that's, you know what, let me back up and tell you, I would not have done that without some information. I ran a survey towards the end of 2004. I ran a survey in which I asked my readers a bunch of questions. I say my readers. The survey had a bunch of questions on it. I got 4,000 responses to the survey.
Wow.
Okay, that's huge.
Yeah.
That if we figure an optimistic 10% of people taking, that means I had about 40,000 readers.
Right.
Okay. At the time, my server stats said I had around 25,000. Daily readers. I didn't know from monthly because I wasn't cookieing people.
Right.
In that survey, I asked, okay, where does Schlock Mercenary fall in terms of your favorite things? And 60% had me at number one favorite, and another 20% had me at their number two favorite. My marketing training at Novell, hands-on marketing training, told me that those 80%, I could take their money.
Yeah.
People will pay for their number one or number two favorite thing. That, and I shared that with my mentor, my marketing mentor, Richard Bliss. I shared that with him, and he said, you can take that to the bank.
Yeah.
And I said, I can? Which bank? Richard, help. And he told me what I already knew, which is, first or second favorite, and you know that that's 3,500 people that will give you money. Now you just need to give them a product. And the survey described, you know, how much would you pay for this book? And essentially, I arrived at my price point, I arrived at the number of books to print, and I figured, based on that survey, and based on crunching the numbers and reducing things, I thought, you know what, I think I'm going to sell about 2,000 books, which, interestingly, is the exact number that Steve Jackson's ops guy said. Said, yeah, I think we'll sell about 2,000 of these.
Nice.
Which I was very pleased to have arrived at the same number independently. We'll sell about 2,000 of them. The pre-order period, which ran for a month, 1,912 books. And the remaining 88 of that 2,000 we sold within, you know, the next 3 months.
Yeah.
And so it was dead on. But without those numbers, without that survey, it would have been fantastically foolish for me to have spent any money on print. I knew I had 3,500 real people who were going to give me money.
Right.
So.
Yeah, we have people with 600 readers asking when they should put out their first book. So.
You know what? If you want to, honest advice. If you really want to see it in print that badly, spend time learning InDesign and create the PDF, upload it to Lulu. Put your comic in print and hold it in your hands and fall in love with your work in print, but stay in love with your work and keep doing it so that somebody will finally say, hey, you know what, this comic's really cool, I think I'm going to link to it, and boom, you've got 10,000 readers, and maybe then you can start looking at offset print runs instead of pod. I started talking softly in the microphone.
That's quite all right. It's about time that we take a quick break right now. Not really. I just need to switch recordings, but...
Oh, no, you can go ahead and say quick break for station identification. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the webcomic Beacon. We'll be right back.
The webcomic Beacon is hosted on RampageNetwork.com. Be sure to check out our weekly live broadcast on TalkShoe.com. Listen in, chat, or call in at webcomicbeacon.com/live.
So there.
We forgot
Do I have to do all the work? My God.
Well, normally you've never listened to the podcast. Yes, if you wanted to be.
If you were a guest in my house and the lawn needed to be mowed, now don't you think it would be fair to?
Okay, that's rude.
There's an old Indian proverb that says, "On the third day of your guest's stay, hand him a rake."
Nice.
See, so I'm right.
I have not been upgraded to rake status. I've been here for 20 minutes.
No. That is one segment. And if you're here by the third segment, then we'll give you the rake.
Okay. It really depends on how professional you
brush.
As to whether or not you take over. By now, we've usually devolved into discussions about...
No, we're still pretty good at this part. What do you want to head into
with your next segment? I assume these things aren't on...
No, they are on. That's the other thing about my breaks.
He lies.
Oh.
They're about 5 seconds of save time before I switch to the next recording, because I used to not, and I miss some really funny things.
Because people, you know, let their guard down when they don't.
Well, no, it's like some good joke that they say. It's like, dude, I wish to record that.
I'm so glad I did not push the rimshot button on my iPhone.
There you go.
It has a crickets. Noise.
Oh, awesome. I had a few.
I tell you what, I'll go ahead and cue that up so that if you tell another real stinker, it.
Yes, Gus.
Well, that'll come up. But I wanted to go into and expand on what we've already been talking to. You mentioned the luck factor. Me personally, I look at webcomics because I discovered webcomics in 2005 and 2006. I started my own. You know, very hobbyish, very amateurish, doing because I like doing it for a hobby, first and foremost. And when I'm looking at people that are looking for success in webcomics, you know, there's like a mentality. You got to know whether or not you're doing this for the love of it, as in just, I want to do something fun, whether or you really want to make something of this, something where you can, like, do what you love and live off of it. You know, there's a couple ways to look at this. And one thing I was thinking of, as far as success with webcomics on the internet, it's partly skill.
As opposed to webcomics on the subway.
It's partly skill, it's partly luck, it's partly who you know.
And it's a big chunk of damned hard work.
Well, yeah.
You know, I'm going to say David Kellett said this a lot, is that you need to be doing this because you love doing it.
Yeah.
And it's in part, you know, many people look at that answer, and I give that answer a lot too. Maybe many people look at that answer and say, "Man, that's a cop out. You need to be doing it because you love doing it." Yeah, but how do I make money at it? And here's what it comes down to. If you don't love doing it, then when it gets hard, you're going to stop.
Yeah.
Because this is a business that is self-driven. You don't have a boss standing behind you saying, "Hey, dude, pick up the pencil. Pick up the pencil and draw a funny picture for me." You have 10,000 readers out there, or 600 readers, or 2 million readers. I don't know. But they are not in your office saying, "Hey, pick up the pencil, draw me something funny." If they are, you're using Ustream wrong. I don't use Ustream. I just picked a name and it worked. Ladies and gentlemen, this is experimental comedy from somebody who doesn't know the technical tools. So you have to love it. You have to be passionate about it. The other thing about the passion, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow in my presentation called Back to the Drawing Board. The other thing about passion is that passion is the single most important factor in determining whether or not you're going to be excellent at something. Because if you are truly passionate about it, you are going to practice it and work at it and keep grinding at it until you have refined your skills and become excellent.
Yeah.
Now, there are other factors, obviously, like, you know, finding out what you should be practicing versus what you shouldn't be, getting good advice. But if you don't want to do... let me rephrase. If you would not be doing a comic anyway, if you would not be drawing pictures and writing stories anyway, then this isn't a business that you should get into. Because the people who love it more than you do will eat your lunch.
Yes.
Because we want it more, and we're gonna keep moving, and you're gonna get tired and fall down and stop.
See, that's why so many of these penny arcade knockoffs, which I still see, boggle my mind. It's like, oh, all I have to do is draw a couple dudes that look like these two dudes and have maybe different colored shirts and, you know, talk about video games, and I'll be rich and famous and have a lot of sway in the gaming industry.
They believe it's formulaic. They're yeah. Incorrect.
Well, they believe it is formulaic, and they think they understand the formula. I believe it is formulaic, and we don't understand the formula.
Yeah.
Nassim Nicholas Taleb's book, The Black Swan, talks about the role of luck in these sorts of events and how we will tell ourselves stories about somebody's success or somebody's failure.
Yeah.
We tell ourselves these stories, think, oh, they succeeded because of A, B, C, D, and X. And so if I just do A, B, C, D, and X, then I will be successful. And what's funny is that the people telling these stories often pick the wrong things.
Right.
Somebody will say, well, gosh, Nathan Fillion, famous actor, has, you know, 10 million Twitter followers. If I can just get 10 million Twitter followers, I'll be a famous actor. The logical fallacy there is called affirming the consequent. And don't do that. Don't affirm the consequent. Yeah. But Taleb's book tells us that we tell ourselves these stories about why things happen, and we tell ourselves the stories because we want to believe we understand the world around us, and the fact of the matter is we don't. There might be a formula. God knows it. You don't. Don't adhere to the formula. Do it because you love it, and keep doing it until you get lucky.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was on a tear sort of kept going.
Yes, it comes down to the until you get lucky thing. Though with some people that, you know, there's a certain quality of unfairness to the internet.
Internet's against me.
No, it's not me. I'm not trying. I'm doing this for the love of the hobby, and I'm having fun with it. But sometimes, you know, you see people that are very talented, and then you look over this comic that calls itself a comic, and you're like, why are you making so much money? You have, and then it's like this person works so hard. They have great writing, great art. Nobody's paying attention to them. And then it's like this, you know, like the pop sensation is like they're not that good, really. It's just like this stupid. But you understand what I'm saying?
Oh no, I understand it. I understand it completely. My dad, he's. You know, long since passed away, but when I was a kid, I would whine about something. He'd say, Dad, that's not fair. And he'd say, life's not fair. But Dad, you're going to say it's supposed to be fair, aren't you? This should be fair, Dad. Okay, you know what? That's a reasonable suggestion. It's not. It's not fair. It's not going to be fair. You can keep wishing for that, or you can just do what needs to be done. And I remember resenting that advice. I'm paraphrasing. My dad didn't say it exactly like that. Although my voice does sound like his. And when you become your father, it's really creepy.
It's really creepy for me because I have to be my father instead of my mom.
You're way too pretty to have become your dad.
Pretty. You can dress him up. He's all right. All right. He also doesn't listen to the podcast. So.
Oh, well, there you go then. Anyway, so my dad would say that, you know, that life isn't fair. So I look at these kinds of things and I think, and I'm going to say horrible things that your listeners are going
to
revile me over. The entitlement generation is all about, wow, this should be fair. I got affirmed all through grade school and all through junior high school, and I'm special, and this should be fair. And you know what? It's not. I'm sorry, your education and your culture did not prepare you for the real world. The real world is a horrible, horrible place. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful, wonderful place. And the distribution of horrible and wonderful is not fair.
Yes. We've often had the discussion that I had more readers than I should have, from my own estimation. I had great numbers for, you know, while I was updating, I had great numbers, and I wasn't even happy with what I was doing. And he has a brilliant comic.
Yeah.
Mark is an amazing comic.
And he updates
his numbers
updates.
did not, and he updates. And and they did not reflect that. And so, generally, when we're complaining about the numbers game, it's that they're...
it's this internal tension dynamic here behind the microphones.
That I think are so brilliant. I love John Peters' work, and I love Mark's work, and... nobody cares, and I want to strangle the world and make them care. You say it more than I do.
I know, so but it hurts when you say it.
It's like we try to take methods to make it fair.
And it could just be it's the X factor.
You know what, I was on a panel with Jerry Purnell, a science fiction author, back in 2005, I think. And Jerry was talking about writing groups.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a writing group is when you sit down with a group of your peers and you workshop your stuff, and they will tell you to change things and tell you this is working or that isn't working. And writers' groups are, you know, often a really good way to fix a broken novel. And Jerry's response was, writing groups are crap. The only person who matters, the only opinion that matters about your work is the guy who's writing your paycheck. It's your editor. If your editor likes it, it's awesome. And I thought, wow, Jerry, I love your books, but that's, how is this working? And now translating it to your situation,
mm-hmm.
You know, Tanya, as you look at Mark's work,
yes.
You are peers, and you are, you know, fangirling his work. This is wonderful. Everybody should love it. But what's happened is the internet's grand editor, the audience,
Fish.
Is not writing him paychecks.
Yeah.
And that's the opinion that matters. Now, I'm not saying that that's because it sucks. It might be. Mark, I haven't even looked.
Either.
I haven't even looked at your work. I didn't even know it existed until you handed me that keyword. And so perhaps the problem is that. You know, you've
got ad spaces, right? Yeah. Maybe if I put some ads on your site,
I don't know. It may be that the audience has looked at it and said, you know what, this is just not for us. This is appealing to the wrong niche. I've got friends who did comics for years, and I thought their comics were brilliant. I plugged their comics, and the audiences didn't follow it.
Yeah.
I don't know why that happens. But I know that if you want to be successful, you have to listen to the people who are signing your paychecks. And sometimes that means taking your comic and saying, you know what, this was fun. I'm going to keep drawing comics, but I'm not going to keep drawing this one.
Yeah, that's what... Yeah.
So, I'm not suggesting you should quit. Like I said, I haven't even seen it. Is that orange box full of little cards, or is that full of gum?
Little cards.
Okay. I was hoping for gum.
Would you like another one in case you lose the first?
I just hit my pocket.
I mean, if
right
you chew on that for a while, maybe, but...
We have chocolate.
Might be like gum, but yeah.
For those of you not benefiting from video, Mark just handed me gum.
I've got gum, man!
Poor man's comic.
I've got gum!
What's the URL? I'm Twittering this right now.
I gave you a card!
I put it in my pocket!
Another card!
Doesn't even look at the card.
Regret,
he's not
going to
look at the card.
Am I going to regret Twittering this?
Oh, no.
No, I may. But I'll risk it.
You should risk it. I should risk it.
Sorry, Howard's dropped out of the podcast long enough to type. I can't do two things. I can't do two things.
Right. All right. What you were saying is, like, you know, I can think at least two ways to look at it is either... find where your niche audience is hiding and show it to them, or do something else that the audience is already looking for and you know that you can do. I mean, otherwise, if you just, hey, I like this comic, you know, I'm going to keep doing it. I don't care if I have like 10 viewers or whatever. I like this. I'm going to do it.
And that's
go ahead and do it if you like it. You know,
that's
but just don't bitch and moan that you're not having 1,000 viewers because you're not listening.
You know what? If you spend time whining about what you don't have,
James.
You're just wasting time.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's
wishing for a thing does not make it so.
That is true.
But that's not fair!
It's what Captain Picard told Wesley. And that's good enough for me. Shut up, Wesley! Shut up, Wesley!
Yeah, that's better in person. It's actually kind of cool to see you watching him. That's good.
That's pretty good.
I have to imagine it before. It was a lot different in my head, so that's good.
But it's true. Wishing for a thing does not make it so. You have to go out and grab it.
Find your niche.
Yeah.
But sometimes grabbing it can get you in trouble.
It depends on what you're grabbing.
Right.
I know. Don't do that, because you can get in lots of trouble.
Anyway. Okay, we've been Twittered. You can move on to the next one.
Duly tweeted.
Duly tweeted.
Read on a mic before
I throw. Oh, sorry. I now need to eat a piece of the gum. Oh, awesome.
It's good gum.
It's very cool. Gum package. Why are we talking about gum? I'm so sorry.
This is Webcomic Beacon.
Yes, welcome to the Webcomic Beacon.
Are you going to chew gum on a podcast?
You offered him the gum.
I wanted the gum. You see how that works.
You don't always get what you want. We're back to, cliches now.
Well, and my dad, it's awesome. my dad was Minnesota Norwegian, and when somebody offers you something that you asked for, you up and have to consume it.
It's only fair.
So I'm now chewing gum into the microphone, and all the listeners that I send to your podcast who listen to me on writing excuses are going to say, wow, sounds like Mr. Taylor's got stuff in his mouth now.
Is that Chebecki?
Meanwhile, all of our listeners will say, wow, this almost sounds together. What the hell?
Actually, I would say the most together the show has ever been is when I was alone with one other person.
Thank you.
This is going to go to a sex metaphor, isn't it?
No.
He doesn't even bother with metaphors. It's horrible.
I was doing an interview with somebody who does a photo comic called, I think, Night Zero or Zero Night.
Night Zero.
A zombie photo comic. Very good. And so Mark couldn't be there. Tanya couldn't be there. And he was the only person that showed up. So it's just me and him. And it turned into a more or less formal interview, because I don't have anything to bounce off of my co-host. And
are you blaming us for the general?
So this is funny. What's happening?
I blame you for a good, well done show that I don't want to do.
What's happening here is it's the equivalent of being out on a date with one girl and telling her how awesome this other date you had was.
Yeah, way to go.
Yeah,
maybe we ought to do a show without you.
Here's the thing. While it was a good to the point and well done thing, it was not the Webcomic Beacon as I liked it.
This goes right back into your webcomic rant about I'd rather be professional and make money, but I'd rather do what I like.
It goes with dating that other girl. It goes so much more well, and it's more enjoyable.
I don't buy it.
Honey, I was with this other girl.
What's her name, Tramp?
I love the spontaneity of the show with all the guests. No. And the numbers, for some reason, show when we have a podcast that totally just screws up and it shouldn't be successful. The numbers are like two to three times higher than our average show. And it's like,
you realize you just called all your listeners numbers.
Oh man!
No, we have our regular listeners.
People, those of you not benefiting from the video, the look on his face, man, it was like I nut punched his puppy.
No wait. Now look at the look on my face, because Fess is now going to try to backpedal and dig himself out while digging himself deeper in. With the whole, but I didn't mean what I had. I didn't mean what I had. What I had.
Do we have some on-topic sorts of questions? I'm used to the signal to noise ratio being a little lower. So.
I do.
Mark hit me.
I usually ask the sort of technical question. So I'm curious.
Please,
how long does it take you to do a single strip from beginning to end?
Okay. No, that's a fantastic question, which I can't answer without using averages, because I don't write the words and then illustrate the words and then color it. Yeah. What I do is I'll write a week of comics, and then I'll pencil a week of comics, and then I'll ink a week of comics. What it averages out to be, though, is maybe an hour and 20 minutes per row.
Mm-hmm.
So for a standard four-panel row, about an hour and 20 minutes. I can knock the inking down in maybe 25 or 30 minutes if I'm moving fast. The penciling I can often do in 10 minutes. The writing, I spend a lot of my writing time sitting and staring at the screen, reworking the dialogue, reworking, wordsmithing, throwing it away, starting again. because I'm trying to do something that's really quite difficult, which is advance a long-form story arc with a punchline every day. It's like trying to tell a novel via haiku.
Yeah.
So, which it really is. It's, I had no idea that that was what I was getting myself into, and I've discovered that, well, now that I know how to do it, I can make it look easy, and so people assume that it's easy, and
I would personally like to thank you for 3 months of the most torturous time in my life writing comics, because I thought, hey, look, he could do this great thing where he tells a long story and there's this pithy little punchline at the end. That's going to be awesome. I'm totally going to do that. And I ripped my freaking hair out for 3 months over one storyline just trying to make it die so that I could move on doing the funny every day. There's no more storylines.
I was talking with April Lynn Pike, whose debut novel, Wings, hit the New York Times bestseller list. I was talking with her last week at a show, and we both agreed that if you are not making it look easy, you're not a professional yet.
Not even close.
And, the more I think about that, the truer it sounds, because that doesn't mean it's easy for me. Right. It means that people look at what I'm doing and they're like, wow, he just cranks those things out. That must be easy for him.
No, yeah.
It's not, but I'm making it look that way. And I feel good about making it look that way, because sometimes I have days where by the end of the day I look back at what I've done, and this is back to the question of timing, and I realize I got up this morning with nothing, and I'm going home with a whole week scripted, penciled, inked, and it is some of my finest work, and I'm ready to sign it, send it off to the colorist I've hired, Travis, and it feels fantastic. And those are the days when I can almost fool myself into thinking, oh yeah, this is easy, and this will always be easy. And I need to never believe that lie, because
it's kicks your butt.
Yeah,
it's a lot like what Sherlock Holmes used to say, isn't it? It's like he does all the work in his head, and then gives a startling conclusion verbally, and Watson is like, "What's your weird house?" And then when Sherlock goes through step by step, here's how I figured this out: A, B, C, D,
walks
E, F,
down
G.
The path.
He's like, "Of course, it's a super home. By George, it's super." But it's not. But we're only seeing the fantastic deduction, not all the steps that go into it. And this is very much the same.
You just compared me favorably to Sherlock Holmes.
It doesn't have to be the recent movie if you don't like it.
Oh, I loved
it. Was good.
I thought it was really good.
And you know, actually, it brought an appreciation for what you do too. And it's something that I kind of encourage other artists to do. If you see somebody that you enjoy and you see a certain style of writing or a certain style of art, give it a shot for a week. If nothing else, you're going to appreciate what they do a heck of a lot more. And kudos for that 50
years. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. One of the things that I firmly believe in is that there, once you start working at this, and that's what I do now, you know, it is my day job. Once you are good enough to have the job, and this is not original thoughts to me. Anders Ericsson did this research 15, 20 years ago. But once you are good enough to have a job at something, you start kind of phoning it in.
Yeah.
The hard parts are the parts that if you can find a way to work around them, you're still going to get paid. And I looked at my own work, and I regularly look at my own work, and I think, okay, what is it that I am doing that I believe is good enough that I could be doing better? A couple of years ago, I started tackling hands. Realized that, you know what, Captain Tagon stands in parade rest a lot because that way I don't have to draw his hands.
Yeah.
And so I printed out some hands that were drawn by a Disney artist for Sword in the Stone. That is a fantastic set of references. And started using those. I never traced them, but I would look at those and think, how do you, oh gosh, I would not have put that, curve of palm there, but there it is. And so I'm going to do that. And then I would draw the hand that way. And very shortly thereafter, Tracy Hickman asked me to illustrate a role-playing supplement for him, XDM, Extreme Dungeon Mastery. I ended up becoming Tracy Hickman's publisher for a role-playing book, which is one of these opportunities, one of these luck things. You look at it and you think, I couldn't have planned that.
Yeah.
I just happened to be in the right place at the right time, and I had the skills to execute on it. And his son Curtis, who's a practicing magician, said, oh, and one of the things that we're putting in this book is a whole bunch of stuff where you can use simple prestidigitation to enrich the game experience for people, and you need to be able to draw pictures of card tricks And I thought, holy hands, that's, but you know what? The practice that I'd done up until that point where I'd been tackling the hard parts, I then tackled those hands. And those of you who are in the room, is unfortunate for those of you not benefiting from the video or from being at PenguinCon, you really should have come.
Yeah.
Come down to the dealer's room and flip through Extreme Dungeon Mastery, please, and look at the hands I drew. Because, well, what I did, Curtis took pictures of himself doing the key parts of the tricks.
Yeah.
And I started trying to draw the hands and realized, no, I'm getting the negative space wrong. Screw that. I can trace these hands. They're not copyrighted. And so I quickly traced the hands and had the negative space right. And then I pushed the photograph aside. You know how photographs are often washed out and you lose all the detail on the skin?
Mm-hmm.
But because of my study of hands to that point, I knew where the knuckles were, I knew where the lines were, and I created some hands that were no longer Curtis's hands and that more clearly communicated these magic tricks. And I was so thrilled with myself. I was very pleased with my own work, and you should all come down to the dealer's room and look at it.
A lot of people... I think a lot of people have, and unfairly, they've written off Disney stuff because it's all G-rated kid stuff, or they, you know, it's kid stuff, or they think, oh, it's Disney, they're evil, or right. whatever. But there are some fantastic references from the artists of Disney, like the hands. Are there
the hands
other?
And Sword of the Stone are brilliant. The other thing that I would say, I can't remember the name of the artist, and I feel awful for not remembering it. The guy who did the creature design, the character design, the whole artistic design for Lilo and Stitch created bottom-heavy characters.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that that was what he had done until I picked up a sketchbook of his at Comic-Con that had... It didn't have any Lilo and Stitch in it because, of course, Disney owns that lock, stock, and barrel. But I immediately recognized that style, and I thought, man, how did he make fat legs sexy?
Yeah.
How did he do that? And I mean, you know, you look at Frank Cho's work and you think, well, I know how Frank Cho made it sexy. Frank Cho showed us musculature and showed us proportion and made it look real,
right.
while at the same time it really is impossibly, not impossibly proportioned, but impossibly perfect. I mean, unless you're a, you know, fitness professional. But this guy, and I can't remember his name and I feel horrible, I look at what he's drawn and think, what are the lines? What are the lines I need to use in order to make plump look sexy instead of looking, you know, pudgy and stupid?
Yeah.
Because it was all the design was bottom heavy, and but it was wonderful. So there's all kinds of examples like
that. Are there other references that you use like that that people may not know, like the Disney hands or anything like that?
I use circle templates a lot, but I use them principally as a starting point for proportions.
Mm-hmm.
I use French curves for drawing a lot of backgrounds. Does this mean my minion is off the hook? Sorry, the listeners have no idea what I'm just made reference to. I use French curves a lot, and I use a flexible curve template. These are not references, but these are tools.
Right.
And what I found about French curves that's so miraculous is that the French curve tool, it's not a circle, it's not a straight edge, it's something in between, and I don't know what it is about the ratio of the curve, but just laying the French curve on the paper and tracing it to throw something into the background looks right. I don't know why. I don't know what the math is behind it, but I'll throw that line in. Sometimes I'll experiment with the French curve in, you know, all kinds of funky angles, and I've got three or four of the curves, three or four of the tools, so with slightly different shapes, and it shows me where the background needs to be, which is photo references that I use. Let's see. Sometimes I'll go to magazines and look for things like clothing. Oh, Bina Abling's... I forget the name of the book, but it was a fashion design book. Set me back $90. I bought it because Phil Folio says, oh, kid, you want to learn how to draw clothes?
Yeah.
Learn how to draw clothes from the people who teach how to draw clothes. Fashion designers. And so I spent $90 on this book full of fashion sketches, and the thing shows up, and I thought, oh, this is huge. How am I going to get $90 worth of value out of this? And I flip it open, and I realize these fashion designers are not... It's not the... who's the guy who does the dynamic books? Dynamic light and shadow, dynamic faces, dynamic hands.
Christopher Hart?
No, it's not Christopher Hart. It's Hogarth. Bern Hogarth. I've got the Hogarth collection and Dynamic Wrinkle and Drape. I looked at those and thought, oh, wow, look at all the pieces of clothing I'm not currently drawing. And then I opened up this fashion book and realized, oh, fashion designers, art for art's sake, Bernd Hogarth, can take its time. Art for money has to go fast. And these people, these fashion designers, had shorthands, and so I was able to do kind of what I talked about with Lilo and Stitch. I was able to say, oh, what is the line? Mm-hmm. I don't want to know how to draw all of the wrinkle and drape of the human crotch draped in denim. Okay? Right. I want three lines. Is it an N? Is it a Z? Is it a W? Is it cross-hatching? What is it?
Yeah.
It's a Z. At least for most of these. And yeah, that piece right there, suddenly my clothing started to look real as I discovered these shorthand tricks. Should you spend $90 on Bina Abling's book? If you've got the $90 and you want to be a fashion designer, yes. sorry, ran out of steam.
But there's, I mean, there are a lot of things some people do, you know, pose in front of the mirror, go out, and one of the things I got from the documentary on Crumb that I like, and I mention it probably too much, is his son said, I got this piece of advice from my dad, is that you take a camera, and if you have to draw a city or whatever, go out and photograph intersections, and you'll have a reference of how the power lines go and the streetlights, because you can't make that stuff up.
It's very well, and when you do try to make that stuff up, you get the proportions wrong, unless you are an engineer and have already learned that.
And then it doesn't look aged right. Yeah. You know, it doesn't look like it had the right amount of wear or whatever.
Funny story from the World Science Fiction Convention in 2006. I bumped into Phil Folio waiting in line. We were both ditching the Hugo Awards because, well, you know, we wanted to eat sushi instead. We're both waiting in line for sushi, and I tapped him on the shoulder and said, Mr. Folio. And he recognized me and said, oh, well, sure, let's eat together. And so we sat down and ate together, and I had, for 2 hours, Phil Folio all to myself.
Wow.
And we talked and talked and talked, and the more I watched him talk, he's funny, he's personable, I now count him among my, you know, good friends. And as he talked, I'm watching his face and realized, oh, so that's where Agatha Heterodyne gets that expression. Uh-huh. Phil, you've got a mirror over your drawing table, and you've been cheating off your own face. I don't know if he still has the mirror, but I could see his character's facial expressions in his own face. I was amazed on two counts. One, I was amazed that I, as a novice artist, I've been drawing for 6 years, which is nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing in this field. And two, I was amazed that that it could be at all visible, that what he was using as a reference could be noticeable to anybody, that the relationship was actually there. I hope Phil doesn't listen to your podcast, because I've never actually shared this story with him.
I'm going to guess not.
Probably not.
We're going to go out on a limb.
Go out on a limb and say that Phil Folio does other things and listen to the webcomics Beacon.
Pretty sure.
Okay. Sure.
I mean, hey, if you're listening, email. That's really great.
Twitter at Phil Folio.
Yeah.
I don't know what his Twitter account is. Anyway.
Does he Twitter?
One of his characters Twitters.
Well, yeah, I knew the characters. I didn't know if he had a personal one, though. And he's a very personable person. I enjoyed him at Comic-Con.
I am so happy he won the Hugo last year in Montreal. Mm. There's another story that I haven't shared publicly, because hey, you know, what's a podcast for if it doesn't have dirt about celebrities on it?
That's right.
There were several of us up for the Best Graphic Story Hugo, and I was sitting next to one of the other nominees. I can't for the life of me remember her name, and now I feel like a total heel, because the two of us sat there, we're both very nervous, and we confessed to being nervous, and I told her, if you win, I am going to be very, very happy for you. And she said, oh, thank you. I'm so scared. I'm not going to win. If you win, I'm going to be super happy for you. I said, so who do you think is going to win? We all said, well, Joss Whedon's going to win, because Joss Whedon's up for the Serenity Better Days comic. Yeah. And for crying out loud, it's Joss Whedon. And then Phil Folio won. And this woman and I hugged each other in joy, because we felt like Phil deserved it and Joss Whedon didn't. Does Joss Whedon listen to your podcast? Oh gosh, I've just committed career suicide. I loved Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog, but
that
the comics
awesome,
were very ordinary.
Yeah.
I would guess he's a bit busy.
Yeah, he's got to be busier than that. But anyway, we hugged. We were so happy that Phil won, and we were so sad that Phil wasn't actually there.
Yeah.
So Phil and I are both going down to the Hugos in Australia. I got nominated again for a Hugo, and I'm thrilled.
Congrats on that, by the way.
And, well, thank you. And Phil got nominated again, and so the competition is really steep. I looked at the voting afterwards. I came in very solidly in sixth place, so I don't stand a dingo's chance in a kidney pie of winning. I just made up that
dingo's
metaphor.
Kidney. I've heard that bit. It's good.
There are roos loose in your top paddock.
What the hell?
I don't know what that means, but I think I like it.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
And that's all important.
I don't stand a dingo's chance in a kidney pie. I'll stop. It's late, and I'm running out of caffeine. Hey, do we have a wind up for this show?
We actually have.
What we do is we go ahead and we say thank you very much.
That's not what we do. It's more awkward than that.
That's why I took over, because he's a professional. He knows what he's doing.
Okay.
He's been nice the whole time. And instead of crapping all over it, I thought we would say, that's what we're doing right now.
No.
And I usually just sit here and let them do that.
Yeah.
We're supposed to work. We said thank you very much for being on the show. We're going to go ahead and do the news after this.
What's up?
That's fantastic.
It's been very great for you to come on to the show. In fact, I greatly appreciate it, and I probably wouldn't have had the balls to come up to you and ask. So I humbly thank you very much for appearing, and you've shared valuable information for our listeners and for everyone present as well. So thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show and for letting me... talk way, way, way too much. I love the sound of my own voice. And, you know, when I do the Writing Excuses podcast, there's three of us, and we're sharing 15 minutes. And so the opportunity to just wax eloquent for an hour is brilliant. So thank you for giving that to me. And I will be sure to link to this from schlockmercenary.com.
Certainly. And before you go, you have some more panels coming up this weekend. If you would like to go ahead and plug them for... our audience, where will you be?
Okay, let me pull up the calendar here briefly. Tomorrow, I'm talking about world building in Ballroom ABCD. World building is one of my very favorite topics to discuss. I'm talking about how to write humor at 11 a.m. I'm going to make all of you tell dirty jokes to yourself, and I'm going to do it without telling a dirty joke myself. At 1, I'm doing what is probably my favorite presentation of all time. It's called Getting Back to the Drawing Board, in which I discuss the research of Anders Ericsson and Nassim Nicholas Taleb and others, and I kind of play connect the dots and talk about the things that we can do to become really excellent at what it is that we want to do. And then at 4, my wife and I are on a panel called Making a Living as an Artist, and I would encourage you to come to that because we have lots of tips and tricks to share.
Excellent.
And you're coming to the webcomic meet and greet?
Oh, and there's a webcomic meet and greet at 7, which I will definitely come to.
Sign up for it, I found out.
Oh, really?
Like,
I do?
Sign up at ConOps. Or something.
Okay.
Yeah, not to blow my own horn, but I'm a guest of honor. I've been able to just show up to stuff and they let me participate.
They will probably let you participate.
But you guys, you want to sign up.
You got a minion.
I am such a dick.
You got a minion. Send the minion.
We already discussed that what you need to be successful is ignorance and arrogance, so we're good.
I'm both. Wow. That was
awesome.
You know, you've been so kind and complimentary to me. It was nice for you to turn that around right at the end and plunge the knife right into my back.
That's what I'm here for.
You notice she hoarded all the candy. Right, all the candy down there.
Yeah, you say that now.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much. I'm gonna bow out.
Thank you, sir.
Everyone. I don't know where it came from.
It was from the previous
the raspberry.
I'm going to put a raspberry Three Musketeers in my mouth while nobody's looking, because I don't want to see. I don't want you to see a look on my face. I don't know if it's
going to
be any good.
All right,
thank you.
And we've also lost a minion. We've lost a Howard Father.
Well,
minion.
He only brought him like Diet Coke, so for him. So it's not like we benefited. Directly.
Selfish brag.
Indirectly.
No, I'm just saying, you know, well, you're the one who, well, he's gone now.
That's not what I meant.
I didn't know. Jeez.
Anyway, so,
I just didn't
what?
Know. He left my car.
I didn't bring my phone.
No, he got it.
I know, this is the extra card. I'm just funny.
And it doesn't matter. He tweeted it. He has a record.
I know.
He has a record.
There's evidence now.
Evidence. Server or something.
He touched this one. Anybody want to bid on that?
Any questions? Anybody have any questions? Yeah, no, maybe, kind of. Maybe I should have asked when he was here.
I actually
have a milestone, and I don't have it with me, so we'll have to do double milestones next time.
I suppose we'll have to do that.
Something about a duck.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that's all I know.
Something about a duck. All right.
No. We'll announce it next.
There's
week.
Not really much more we can do to this show except make it, I guess, more make it.
I'll just
good.
Say boobs, and we can leave.
There we go. So, if there are no more questions about
the show, anybody want to know anything horrible?
Yeah.
It's late.
Beacon After Hours.
What?
This is like an uncle with an opportunity thing, and I can't think of what to think of.
This is.
We,
it's wide open. We'll answer horrible things.
For anyone that may have additional questions after the show, or if you're listening to this on MP3, you can email us at webcomicbeacon@gmail.com or call our voicemail at 1-320-310-0922 and leave a message, and we'll likely hear it. Though in the past year of me having that number, I have received absolutely zero calls.
That was very nice.
No cue card or anything.
I know.
I'm impressed.
Well, then
I didn't offer, though, to answer horrible questions for the rest of my life. I just figured tonight.
Hey, if just I get some hate mail, it's at least mail. I mean, I may ignore it, but... Hey! So that is it for the Webcomic Beacon. And once again, it's at webcomicbeacon.com. And really, people should know that. By now, I mean, almost everyone in here knows about us already. And really, there's not that much more we could add to this show. So we're going to close it off here. I've been Fest of PSIWebcomic.com.
This is Tanya of DaisiesandTrip.com.
And this is Mark of AutumnLake.com.
Thanks to everyone who came to our panel at PenguinCon 2010.
Good show!
That's all for the Beacon. Be sure to tune in next week.
Every time.
You pass gas? Is that what you said?
No, I didn't like yay!